This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
For more than 30 years, Joe and Maddie Harvey and their country store were an institution in the small town of Lewis Chapel Mountain, Tennessee. Then in March of 1991, Joe and Maddie were brutally murdered. A grieving community was shattered by the news that one of the primary suspects was a member of the Harveys' own family. In 1941, Barney Dewey and his sister Angela were taken from their parents, separated and placed for adoption by a deceitful preacher posing as a friend. A year later, Barney set out on a lonely journey to find his sister. Perhaps you can help bring his long search to an end. In Henderson, Nevada, two unknown bank robbers took a woman hostage and led police on a dangerous high-speed chase. Incredibly, as the escape unfolded, an alert newspaper reporter snapped a picture of the bandits from her passing car. Also thanks to our viewers, nine brothers and sisters who were separated by the tragic death of their mother have found each other. Join me. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. According to official FBI files, on any given day, an estimated 40 banks in the United States are robbed at gunpoint. On November 13, 1991, a bank in Henderson, Nevada was added to the list. It is a frightening, traumatic experience for the bank employees, who, fearing retribution, have asked that their identities be concealed. It began an hour before opening. The bank manager was at his desk, alone, seemingly secure behind locked doors.
Touch the alarm! Did you set off the alarm?
No.
This is a robbery. I want you to do everything I tell you to do. Now, is there anything you have to do now?
I have to sign on my computer and I have to check my daily mail.
Let's do it.
The first thing that I saw was the handguns that both of them had. They were like a stub-nose, large caliber weapon. I believe the individual was a professional bank robber because he knew about banking procedures.
All right, do what you have to do.
He watched every move that I made up and down the teller line to make sure that I didn't reach down and set off any alarms.
All right, I'm in.
I just stand there.
The robbers had apparently done their homework.
Don't look at me.
They seemed well aware that the bank's vault was equipped with a dual combination lock. The manager knew the first half of the six-digit sequence. The other three numbers were known only to the vault teller. At 8 a.m., she arrived for work.
When I was unlocking the door, I kind of felt that there was something wrong, but I went ahead and entered anyway.
Don't touch the alarm! Do you know the other information to open this vault?
Yes, I do.
Open it! Come on!
The bank robber was pretty calm, I thought. He was just really precise in what he wanted us to do. So my manager and I, we opened the outer door and we all went inside the vault and we went to go to the inner vault where the cash was.
Now this is what I want you to do. You'll go across the lobby to my partner and stay there. Now go. You go outside and stand by the vault door and don't move.
Two tellers were also taken hostage by the second gunman when they arrived for work.
first.
At some point during this phase of the heist, a silent secret alarm was activated. Police moved in cautiously and staked out the bank.
The robbery was very well planned out, but we were able to make it to the bank, we believe, without their knowledge. Had they have known we were on our way to the bank, I believe they would have left the bank prior to our getting there to avoid the confrontation.
Once officers were in position, the police dispatcher placed a call to the bank, trying to find out if a robbery was in fact in progress.
I gotta get the phone.
Get it.
Valley Bank.
This is the Henderson Police Department. We're receiving a silent holdup alarm from your business. Is everything okay there?
My stomach was in my throat.
I suppose.
I didn't know really what I was going to say or how I was going to say, but I knew that I had to alert this person that there was a problem within my branch. And my normal procedures would be joyful and tell her that everything was okay. This time I just told her that, yeah, I suppose everything's okay. That alerted the dispatcher that there was definitely something wrong within my branch.
Everything's all right.
Set off the alarm, didn't you?
No, I did not.
Who were you just talking to?
There's someone else here with me.
Okay. What I need you to do is I need you to go outside and speak with my officers. Can you do that for me?
Okay, very well. That's the store across the street. They think there's something up here. They're gonna call the authorities. I gotta go. I have to straighten this out with them.
Go outside and take care of it.
The hardest thing that I had to do was to walk up my teleline and see my three employees tied up, knowing that once I left that bank, that I couldn't get back in to do anything to help them.
This is taking too much time.
One Robert, he was really, really nervous, and he was mumbling to himself.
Too much time.
I was nervous, of course, but I wasn't freaked out, I guess, as some people would say. I kept my cool. I didn't say anything. I didn't make them nervous or jittery, you know, that I was, you know, going to cause them problems.
No one knows if the gunmen were aware that the police were outside.
Let's go. Grab one of those women. Let's get out of here.
You, come on. Stop.
For reasons known only to himself, one of the holdup men removed his mask as he left the bank. What had begun as a robbery had suddenly escalated into a dangerous hostage situation. Had obviously been planned well in advance. The robbers managed to confuse their pursuers as they entered the labyrinth of a large apartment complex.
There are only three entries and exits from that apartment complex, and there are probably 6 to 8 dead ends in that apartment complex, and they seem to have known exactly which route to take through there.
When I was in the car, I wasn't sure what was going to happen to me. I kept my eyes closed for the most part, so they wouldn't want to kill me since I could identify them. So I automatically laid down on the back seat.
Police sealed off all possible exits in an attempt to trap the robbers. Incredibly, the bandits made good their escape. A short time later, they switched getaway cars and released their hostage unharmed. Authorities believe that the two men who robbed the Henderson Bank may be responsible for as many as 10 holdups during the past 5 years. In every case, their disguises successfully concealed their identities, leaving investigators with absolutely nothing to go on. But the Henderson holdup would be different.
That morning, newspaper reporter Catherine Scott heard of the robbery on her police scanner.
I ran out of the office to my car with the camera and my scanner. As I was going, I heard my scanner say that there were three people tied up in the bank. There was a hostage in the car. The robbers had a semi-automatic handgun, a semi-automatic pistol, and they were heading my way on Sunset Road with the police behind them. I saw the car and decided that that had to be the car. And that's when I thought, I can take a picture. But I was afraid to take the picture because if I lifted up my camera and took the shot, then I knew that they had plenty of time to react by lifting their weapons and shooting me. That's when my heart started to pound. And I don't know how much time passed. It couldn't have been very long. But I kept thinking, I can take this picture, but he'll shoot me. I can take this picture. I can take this. I want to take this picture. I have to take this picture, but he'll shoot me. And just as we passed, that was it, the moment of truth. And so I took it.
This is the photograph that Catherine Scott took that morning. Authorities have enhanced it to make the unmasked driver more recognizable. From this image and eyewitness descriptions, the FBI created a composite drawing of the suspect. He is Caucasian or Hispanic, between 40 and 50 years old, 6 feet 2 inches tall, and weighs approximately 220 pounds. No photographs exist of the other robber without a mask. He is believed to be in his late 30s, is 5 feet 9 inches tall, and weighs around 175 pounds. Next, a man's poignant search for the sister he hasn't seen in 50 years. More than 50 years ago, the United States began a brutal downward economic spiral that lasted just over a decade. Officially, the Great Depression ended in 1942. But for many, the cost and personal tragedy would continue for a lifetime. Such was the case for a young girl and her older brother who lived in Haskell, Texas. In 1941, Barney Dewey was just 12 years old, but he had already been forced into manhood.
And the charge was 63 cents. Now how much change do I have? 37
cents?
That's right.
Well, here you go, sir.
No, no, you keep that, that's yours.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wilson.
You're welcome, and I'll see you again.
Barney worked part-time at a gas station and looked after his little sister, Angeline. Their stepfather was hospitalized, and their mother toiled long hours as a garment worker.
Times were rough in those days, and we were concerned with living and trying to keep body and soul together. And so, and my mother was trying real hard. You know, she was not a well-educated person, but she could read and write and what have you, but that was the only job that was available.
Do you wanna play a game with me?
Okay, what do you wanna play?
Books.
It was a bleak existence, but Barney and his family managed to scrape by and stay together until the day in the spring of 1941 when Barney and Angeline had a visitor, a kindly old man named Reverend Nicholas.
Help you, sir.
Hello. You're Barney Dewey, aren't you? Well, I'm Reverend Nichols.
Nice.
Most people call me Daddy Nichols.
Oh, Daddy Nichols.
Yeah, I'm a good friend of your mother's.
So he told us that my mother wanted us to go with him.
She said it would be all right if I came over and took you and...
The way he put it and the way he expressed himself, well, there's nothing wrong, you know, just go with him. And my mother, I thought, well, you know, that perhaps my mother was sick.
So you're sure she's going to be there later?
Yeah, she's going to be... Hello, you're Angeline, aren't you? Well, how would you like a piece of candy?
He was a very personable person, and he was very nice, and he could quieten your fears real easy with just a few words, and with his candy, which he always had in his pocket.
Glad. Come along. There you go. There you are. What?
Reverend Nicholas took Barney and Angeline to a fancy hotel, bought both of them new outfits, and fed them a sumptuous dinner. The next day, all dressed up in their new clothes, the children were formally photographed.
There you go. Now, go on over here and we'll find the bus waiting for us.
They said that that something had happened to my mother and that we weren't able to see her. And so they took us to the bus station. And I questioned him, asked him, well, where are we going? He said, well, so we're going to take a little trip. And don't worry, everything's going to be all right. Well, my sister balked, and she began to cry.
On this bus? Barney, on this bus.
Now, it's all right. Don't worry. Don't worry. I talked to your mom. She said she'd meet us.
Every time we would raise some objection, well, he would smooth our feelings down and say, well, everything's going to be all right, you know. Just we'll go see your mother. I still had in my mind that we were going to see our mother, that all of this was taking place to get us transported to the place that she was. And so this is the way it happened. And it worked out for Reverend Nichols just real well. We kind of trusted him. And when we got to the foster home, we just felt like that was a place that we was to stay until we met my mother.
Morning, girl.
A few days later, Barney realized that his trust had been misplaced. Reverend Nicholas and his adopted son, Nick Crane, came to the orphanage to pick up Barney, but not Angeline.
Come on, it's time for lunch, and we're going to our house. And we'll
you can't take him now.
Oh, we're just taking him for some food.
And, of course, Angeline began to cry and sob and held on to me and followed me out, you know, and she had to be restrained.
Barney, you promised me we're going to find our mom.
Only later did Barney understand that the fancy new clothes and the photograph had been nothing more than an advertisement to be shown to prospective foster parents. Barney was sent to live on a ranch outside Abilene, Texas. His foster parents are Reverend Nicholas's secretary and her husband, who conveniently needed a ranch hand.
I had the responsibility of driving the tractor and plowing and doing the chores on the ranch to keep the animals up and everything, keep them fed and what have you. And I was pretty satisfied right at first there, you know, because I had my own horse and I could do whatever I wanted to do, you know, and on the ranch. I was kind of in charge. Really felt good about it.
Barney's memories of his foster parents are fond ones, even though he lived a solitary existence 8 miles from the main ranch house and saw them rarely. As time passed, Barney yearned for his own family more and more.
I began to get lonely, and I began to miss my mother and my sister. Well, I just got so upset that I began to think about, you know, maybe I ought to get away from here and go look for my mother. Well, I felt obligated to my foster mother and father, and so I took my clothes off, took my good clothes off that they had bought me and everything, and I just laid them aside and put my old clothes on that I'd came to them with. And I made sure I had my money with me. Yeah, I had 37 cents in my pocket. I decided I was gonna go to Haskell and look for my mother.
It was 97 miles from the ranch to Haskell. When Barney got there, he discovered that his mother and stepfather had moved away. Thus began a personal odyssey for Barney Dewey, one that would crisscross Texas and cover nearly 1,000 miles. Barney found his birth father in Cleburne. Together, they traveled to Kilgore, Texas, then on to Humble, just outside Houston. There, Barney's father put him on a bus to Odessa, where he would be reunited with his mother and stepfather.
Is
When I got off of the bus in Odessa, Texas, and I looked over and I saw my mother, and I recognized her, of course, but she didn't know me.
It's me.
Oh, darling. Oh,
I'd changed in the year that had passed, and I had glasses on, and of course, my dad had bought me some new clothes.
You are so brave to go all this way.
We had a wonderful time there, and then she says, where's Angie?
Have you heard from Angeline?
No.
No.
But she's doing okay, though.
Oh,
we began to talk about the events that had taken place, and I asked her, I says, Mama, I said, did you sign any kind of papers or anything to release us to these people? And she says, no. Honey, says, I'd never do that.
Barney lived happily with his mother and stepfather until he was 18 years old. In 1947, Barney married. 4 years later, he and his wife traveled to Abilene, trying to locate Reverend Nicholas. Barney asked around and discovered that Nick Crane, the Reverend's adopted son, owned a pharmacy in town.
Hi, I'm Nick Crane. Can I help you?
Yes, I'm Barney Dewey. This is my wife, Stella.
Hi, Barney.
I don't know if you'll remember me or not.
Nick Crane told Barney that Reverend Nicholas had died 2 years earlier and that his orphanage had been shut down by the state. Whatever records existed were stored haphazardly behind the pharmacy. Barney and his wife sifted through the dusty papers, but found nothing that could lead them to Angeline.
For the last 50 years, I have been searching for my sister, and I haven't been able to contact her, and I have nobody that knows anything about her. And it has been this long, 50 years, half a century, in my search for my sister, Angeline.
The night of our broadcast, Barney Dewey's prayers were answered when Neil Smith of Cedar Hills, Texas, recognized Angeline as his adopted sister, Martha Jean. Martha Jean is mentally handicapped and lives at a group home for the disabled in Arizona. Barney immediately made arrangements to reunite with his sister at his daughter's home in Chandler, Arizona. On March 23, 1992, the moment Barney had waited more than 51 years for finally arrived.
Barney, she's dead. Barney. Open the door.
Hello, Angie. Can you get out of there all right now?
No.
Well, it's good to see you.
Wow.
Oh, goodness. After all this time.
Yeah.
Goodness, look at me.
I know. Look at me. Oh, no.
Goodness. It's good to see you, I'm telling you. Hey, I'm telling you, it was a real thrill. You know, I mean, it's hard to describe, but, you know, and there she was, and my search is ended. I found who I was looking for all of these years. And the only thing that I, only regret I have is that my mother was not there to greet her. My little sister. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the way we were standing when we took that picture, you know.
Yeah.
Back there in Abilene,
mm-hmm.
Just before we were separated.
Separated.
Yeah, that's right.
And, it's joy now, that I found Barney and all his family here. I'm happy that I found that I've got two families now. Instead of one, I've got two. And I'm really happy. Yeah.
This is your sister, Opal Faye. She really was thrilled when you were born.
I look like her.
And there's Barney Dewey, your brother.
Yeah. That afternoon, Barney and Martha Jean began to fill in the details of the years they had spent apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is your mother.
My mom.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
boy.
Your mom. And she was 51 great. Years old there.
51?
Yeah. I got the information that she was treated right and had been raised properly and had gotten an education and had been loved. And so that really was the ultimate as far as I was concerned.
When I got back to Odessa.
Uh-huh. Well,
I really feel good. I mean, really, this is an exciting high point in my life, and I'm really glad that everything turned out like it did, and our dream has really come true.
To Mr. Nichols, try to find it.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. In
On May 31st, 1974, funeral services were held for 34-year-old Wanda Vess in Toledo, Ohio. Wanda left behind 9 children. The oldest was 16, the youngest just 10 months. The children's father, James Vess, did not attend the funeral. He was in jail, charged with the murder of his wife. 3 days earlier, James Vess brutally gunned down Wanda at a tavern where she worked. He later pled guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison, where he died in 1983. In one senseless and violent moment, James Vess had shattered his entire family. Within days of their mother's funeral, the 9 Vess children were sent to live in separate homes.
I think for some reason, I felt we had enough family that some kind of way we would all be kept together, but I was wrong. It was like nobody wanted us. We were taboo, you know. To be around us would be to remember what happened, to have to accept it, and they didn't want that. So to me, we were punished for what my father did, because we weren't even allowed to have each other.
In 1986, with the love and encouragement of her husband and 2 daughters, Shireen began searching for her missing brothers and sisters, whom she had not seen in 11 years. Incredibly, it took Shireen only 2 months to find 4 of her brothers. Within the next 2 years, she managed to locate 2 of her sisters and another brother. But one of the Vess children still remained unaccounted for, Shireen's brother Heath, who was 6 years old when they were separated.
I actually had a dream one night that there was all 9 of us in a room, and I just know that I'm going to get them all together.
The night of our broadcast, Shireen's dream of finding her brother Heath came true when he called our telecenter. Heath, who is now married and living in Ohio, was shocked to learn he'd been featured on national television. The next day, Heath spoke with his sister for the first time in more than 17 years. 4 weeks later, Heath, accompanied by his wife Robin, arrived in Los Angeles for a special reunion with 5 of his brothers and sisters.
I was really excited. I just wanted to get out of the car. You know, I was thinking, you know, who am I gonna hug first, you know? And I didn't want anybody to start bawling or anything, you know? I just wanted to get out and hug everybody at once, basically.
When I heard Heath was found, I was actually kind of numb. I thought it would take months. I didn't know that people would just call in and it would be that easy. I'm glad it was, because it's been a long wait.
Meeting everybody, it's changed my attitude a lot. It's picked up my attitude because, you know, I've had a lot of feelings. You know, I had that unwanted feeling. And I never really knew why, but now since they found me, I have that wanted feeling now, and it's a good feeling, because I never really knew, you know.
Finding Heath and this reunion is the first day of a new beginning. I know when we all leave here that we're all going to leave here differently. It's going to be better for all of us.
The picturesque forests of the Appalachian Mountains are dotted with small, tranquil communities where everyone knows their neighbor and families take root for generations. Joe Harvey and his wife, Maddie, called Teat by friends, exemplified the unique character of the area. For 35 years, the Harveys ran a combination convenience store and automobile repair shop in Lewis Chapel Mountain, Tennessee, just northwest of Chattanooga. It was the only place to buy gas or groceries for miles around, and served as a gathering place for the community.
Teat liked to talk a lot, and Joe was quieter than Teat was, but Teat liked to talk a lot. That was kind of like the community newspaper, in other words, right there. They just knew everybody, and anybody needed help, they would help. It was pretty well common knowledge that they kept cash receipts from the store.
Hey, Patty. How
I asked them time and time again not to keep that kind of money around, but they needed a bank account. And Joe, I tried to get him to even get a gun and put in a garage and station there where he's at, and he wouldn't even do that. Trusted people too much.
Get some supper before you fall asleep
on the TV. Joe and Maddie were such a fixture that everyone figured they would be there forever. Then came March the 4th, 1991. The local sheriff was called to the Harvey's house by a concerned neighbor. For the first time in memory, the store was not open at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning.
I walked up a little steps, like where you go up to the back door, and reached to the handle of the door, and it was unlocked, so I just pushed the door open.
Joe, Pete.
The inside of the house was completely gutted. Joe and Maddie were nowhere to be found.
And I just turned and come back out onto the porch. I discovered blood spots with some hair fragment and flesh. So that gave me a funny feeling that something had really happened at that point.
Agents from the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, arrived on the scene. State arson investigators soon found a 2-gallon gasoline can on the kitchen table.
The investigators found various blood spots throughout the house and on porch and steps leading from the house. The conclusion is obvious. The arson was set for an attempt to cover up crimes that had been committed there. And so with the idea of that we had been informed that they did keep large sums of money, first reaction is there had been a robbery.
I just thought maybe they might have been kidnapped. I thought maybe they'd went on the Smokies or something like that. But when I got to the mountain and they told me they'd found blood and the house had been burned inside, and I didn't know what to think at that point. All I could think about was hoping that they were still alive.
A large-scale search of the area yielded absolutely nothing. The disappearance of Joe and Maddie Harvey left their family and friends stunned. That sort of thing just did not happen in Lewis Chapel Mountain. But soon the community would be rocked again. Another member of the Harvey family would mysteriously vanish. Joe and Maddie had no children of their own, but were extremely close to their extended family, especially their niece, 27-year-old Cheryl Holland, and her young daughter.
Hey, Cheryl.
Hey, John.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hey, Pete could not have loved Cheryl anymore if she hadn't been her own daughter. That's the way she felt about her, and she felt that way about the little girl of Cheryl. She loved that little girl to death. I mean, she thought that little girl was all they were.
1 week after Joe and Maddie disappeared, Cheryl's pickup was found abandoned at a truck stop 2 hours from home.
Investigators found the truck unlocked. They found keys in the truck, and they found a necklace that has later been identified as hers laying beside the truck. Also, her pocketbook was still in the truck. The evidence they found on the scene would lead a reasonable person to assume there had been an abduction.
What time did you leave Ross, lady?
It's about the middle of the morning on Wednesday.
TBI agents soon questioned Cheryl's common-law husband, Eddie Wooten.
About noontime on
he tells about her taking him to Newport News, Virginia. Well, he tells about stopping at a place where they slept.
What was the name?
But he can't remember where they stopped. So we kept finding many, many inconsistencies such as that. We have two missing people, now we have three, all out of a very close, immediate family, even, as I say, living next door in many times in her life. The favorite niece is missing. There's no money in the house, the arson, the blood. It all bills. And then the question is she really missing? Is she an abductee? Or is she part and parcel of a crime?
As far as thinking that Sherry was involved in anything, the TBI asked me, I was telling him that we'd had about all the grief we could take.
because we'd lost a brother-in-law and a sister-in-law, you know. And he wanted to know, was it connected? I think it was connected. And I said, no, there ain't no way. I mean, you know, Sherry was a Christian girl, and she was living Christian life, and there's no way that Sherry's involved in this. This is altogether a different story.
Eddie, when was the last time you saw Cheryl?
It's like I said, when she dropped me off at Newport News.
Okay, where was Cheryl the week
before? On March 10th, Eddie Wooten was questioned again. He told authorities that in late February, he took Cheryl to a hospital in Knoxville for a week-long treatment of stomach cancer.
What was the name of the hospital?
I don't remember.
You don't remember the name of the hospital?
We had been told by the family that she had borrowed money and gone to other institutions for supposed treatment of a cancerous condition, and we found that not to be true. On the day in question that he claimed that he left her in Knoxville for treatments, she in fact was working in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
How could she be in Knoxville at the hospital and here in Chattanooga working at the truck stop at the same time, Eddie?
If I tell you what happened, what's going to happen to me?
Finally, Wooten broke down, and a tale of heartless betrayal began to unravel. In all, Wooten would tell his story three different times. What follows is based on the court records of Eddie Wooten's confessions.
That whole week, Cheryl worked at the truck stop, and I stayed at home. On Saturday, I guess, March 2nd, Cheryl came home from work, and she started telling me that she needed more money. So that night, we were going to go up to her mother's so Cheryl could pick up a paycheck.
On the day or in question and towards the evening hours, they stopped by a service station and purchased a gas can and filled it up with gasoline. They then went up on the mountain where her parents lived, where she went in to talk to her mother, and from there they drove to the residence of Joe and Maddie Harvey.
We gotta do it. We need the money.
You don't need it that bad.
We need it. They got more than they need, and I know where they got it. Eddie, are you gonna help me do this or not?
According to Wooten, he and Cheryl were not alone that night. When they went into Joe and Maddie's house, they left their six-week-old son and Cheryl's five-year-old daughter in the cab of their truck.
You got the gun?
What do I need a gun for?
Because we're going to have to kill them.
Kill them? Kill Joe and Tee?
Do you think they're just going to hand over the money? Look, Eddie, we got no choice. Now, come on!
And I said that I didn't want to kill them. But she said that I was going to have to help her to do it. And so I said I would.
Hey, Joe.
Oh, hi, Cheryl. How you doing?
Where's T?
Oh, she's in the back bedroom.
Bedroom, and I shot her in the head. Cheryl, she told me to go out into the driveway and tell the kids to get down onto the floorboard of the truck.
According to Wooten, he and Cheryl stuffed the bodies into the trunk of Joe and Maddie's own car. Next, Wooten followed Cheryl as she drove the Harveys' car across the Alabama state line. They stopped at the Bridgeport Ferry on the Tennessee River. According to Wooten, Cheryl later returned alone to Joe and Maddie's house. She stole an estimated $150,000 in cash, and then tried to cover up the crime. Two days later, Shell brazenly returned to the crime scene again, even as investigators were searching for evidence.
She intended, obviously, for the house to burn completely, and the house did not burn. As a result of that, the gas can was left basically intact on the kitchen table.
You're not gonna believe what's on the bottom of this can.
What's that?
Bloody fingerprint.
Hey, Mike. Come here. Shoot the print.
And from that gas can, we were able to obtain a latent print, which definitely matched up to the known thumbprint of Cheryl Holland.
I was mad. I was hurt because I couldn't believe that she would do anything like that. Not at all. Cheryl would not have had that in her.
I've done hurt so much on Cheryl that it didn't shock me anymore. I mean, it was, I just felt like it was Cheryl and Eddie, and at this time, I felt like she was as much involved as Eddie was.
Searchers began dragging near the Bridgeport Ferry. On Wednesday, April 17th, they found the Harveys' car. Joe and Maddie had both been shot in the head, just as Eddie Wooten described.
The hardest part is when I had to identify the bodies. I just identified them and walked off there for a few minutes. I had to. That was a bad thing, to look at them. The way I'd always seen them at the store and everything, and to see them in the trunk of this car, it was bad, really bad.
Eddie Wooten was arraigned on charges of first-degree murder. A warrant was immediately issued for Cheryl Holland's arrest on the same charges. Investigators began to track her movements in the days just after the killings. She seemed to be traveling alone, having left her children with her mother. But authorities soon learned of a mysterious man who had apparently been following her. On March 7th at 9:30 p.m., 5 days after the murder, Cheryl was seen by a service station attendant in Greenville, Tennessee.
Hi, can I help you?
I was gonna get some gas, but I gotta go.
We have a witness that saw Miss Holland talking to a male with a beard and a black leather jacket driving a red and white pickup truck. Miss Holland didn't seem to have any desire to talk to the bearded man. She left the scene and the truck with the male in it followed behind her in the same direction.
About an hour later, Cheryl was spotted using a payphone at a truck stop 12 miles from the service station. She called her family and said she was 2 hours from home. Later, another witness spotted two people talking inside Cheryl's pickup truck.
A man meeting the same description of the bearded person seen in the Greenville area had come to Cheryl Holland's place of business on the day before the murders, and she was seen writing this man a check. Now, whether or not that is the same man, whether or not a bearded man has any involvement in this at all, of course, would be idle speculation on our part, and we have no factual basis to conclude that he is.
Cheryl was last seen at the truck stop around 11:30 p.m. that same evening.
Whether or not she planned this disappearance prior to the homicide, or whether or not the disappearance was impulsive, I don't know. But we as prosecutors and investigators do feel that she is alive and has assumed a new identity somewhere.
You're innocent until proven guilty, and I don't think they're giving her the benefit of the doubt as much as I would like for her to be. I think that Eddie went berserk, and Cheryl was just there. She didn't know what to do. If she did burn the house, it was the only way that she could figure that she could get away from Eddie. Until she could see that it was safe for her and her babies, she's just gonna have to go and try to help him as far as what happened to Cheryl. I think Eddie or someone that he knows has done something to her, has killed her.
Eddie's first place not got that much education. Second place, Eddie did not know. Eddie and Sherry had been together about a year, and Eddie had no way of knowing Joe and them had a lot of money in the house.
A year has passed since the murders of Joe and Mattie Harvey, yet a number of questions remain. Did Cheryl Holland mastermind the murders? If so, what could drive a woman to kill the aunt and uncle who loved her so much? Did Cheryl stage her own disappearance to escape justice? Or did she simply fall prey to an unknown assailant, possibly the mysterious bearded man? No one will ever know exactly what transpired on the night of the murders until Cheryl Holland is found. Authorities believe she is still alive and has fled Tennessee. Her common law husband, Eddie Wooten, remains behind bars awaiting trial. Update, Austin, Texas. Less than an hour after our broadcast, Cheryl Holland was captured thanks to a viewer's tip. Holland was arrested at this convenience store where she'd been working for 6 months under the assumed name Amy Forrester.
I asked her if she was Cheryl Holland, and she said yes. And that was about it. We put her in handcuffs at that point, placed her under arrest.
Employees of the store were shocked to learn of their co-workers' double life.
The first thing that got to my mind, no, that can't be her. Not Amy. The only thing she said last night, she said, I'm sorry. I got myself into a mess, and I will get myself out of it.
4 days later, Cheryl Holland was returned to Tennessee to face charges of first-degree murder.
Any time that you apprehend someone that's a fugitive in a case like this, a case of double homicide, you're relieved, and yes, we're relieved from that standpoint.
If convicted of the charges against her, Cheryl Holland could receive the death penalty. Join me next time for another fascinating edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Thank you.